Everybody, welcome to our National Center for Family Philanthropy monthly topical call for the Community Foundation Family Philanthropy Network. This call series is on the second Tuesday, always at 2 p.m. Eastern for no more than an hour. And this is your opportunity to learn from your peers, ask questions of one another, provide your own tips and insights on the topic of the day. I'm Katie Scott, your program director for the Community Foundation Network. And we're going to start with a few housekeeping logistics. One, your lines are unmuted. So if you have a wonderful baby, puppy, all of those things, we can forcibly mute you, but we try not to. So please feel free to mute yourself if you'd like. And if we forcibly mute you, we'll chat you. Jen or I will let you know and we'll unmute you in a little bit. I know we all have those moments. This is meant to be an interactive conversation. Remember to say your name and your city when you talk, just so that people know who you are. And we're recording the call for your network Dropbox, just the audio only. And folks who miss it can check it out there. So before we get started, we can do a round of introductions. And I'm going to tell us what our topic of the day is too, so that you guys just know. It is supporting families with a small shop and truly just kind of a space for you to get to know other community foundations as a part of this family philanthropy network that are supporting giving families. And you know, they don't come to the table and say, I'm a donor service at a shop of 20. They come to the table and say, I might be it all by myself and I have more things to do in my job. So we just wanted to make space for you guys to connect because I think sometimes you can see some of the bigger shops and it's just hard to figure out how to connect on all those different levels. And also, how do some people do it that are new and how do people do it that are more established? And how can you learn from one another and meet your peers? So that's the goal of our time together today. So if it's okay, we have three amazing speakers, Vicki, Nicole, and Ellen, and we'll have them introduce themselves last. So why don't we just let everybody else go around and say their name and their city. And if you have a question for Vicki, Ellen, and Nicole to share about, but truly we'll have them share for like 5 minutes on what they're up to and you know how they do it. And then we'll have a dialogue. So I'm just gonna call on you, but you know, if something happens, we'll go to the next person. So Stacy, if you want to say hi, maybe share your name, your city. So I'm Katie Scott in Tacoma Park. And how many people are in your family philanthropy team? For example, NCFP has less than 15 staff. So somebody came to me and said they had a 20 person staff. I'd say, your donor services staff outweighs our whole team. So Stacy, do you want to share maybe a little bit and then we'll go around?
So my name is Stacy, and I am at the Greater Tacoma Community Foundation. So we're in Tacoma, Washington, about 30 miles south of Seattle. And our fill team is four people, three kind of forward-facing, and then one amazing support staff.
Awesome. Sarah, do you want to share? And then we'll have Jennifer Curry.
I'm Sarah Lang, and I am from the New Hampshire Community Foundation, and we are actually probably a bigger foundation in general, but we still struggle really with meeting the needs, especially of giving families, especially of families that have only part of their philanthropy with us, and most of it is actually their own foundation, and so we find ourselves doing a lot of the work that they then don't have to pay someone to do for their foundation. And it's, and you know, I'd love to get, part of what I'm interested in is where do you balance the, you know, being a good neighbor and helping the whole community versus using your staff time for something that's not actually helping the foundation at all, if that makes sense.
And you guys, I used to live near, like miles from New Hampshire. You guys have how many offices, just so people know?
So we are one of the very few statewide foundations. We're the only community foundation in the state. And so we are split into 8 regions. I'm in the region that is close to Vermont and close to Dartmouth College. That's kind of what our area is. And my group, there's actually 3 of us that work in this part of the state.
You have a small staff for, you know.
Yeah.
A region of the state. But you will be joined by another one. So Jennifer Curry is next up and also from a statewide. And I will just push next that we'll go to Amy after that. And Abby had typed in, she's having a bad allergy day. So Abby, if you don't want to talk, if you chat, we'll type. Otherwise, we'll have you go after Amy. So Jennifer.
Hi, everybody. I'm Jennifer Curry with the Oregon Community Foundation. I work out of our Portland Metro office. We have 5 offices around the state, and we've divided the state into 8 regions. We're a big foundation. We have about 90 employees. There are 2 of us that are focused on family services, but we've worked really hard across the organization to make a process so we can get buy-in to get support from the program team if we need it, or the research team. So I feel like we really are a bigger team than the 2 of us. And our donor services team is about 13 right now.
Awesome. Amy, do you want to share next? And then we'll go to Abby.
Sure. I put myself on mute. So I just figured no need for you guys to see me keep blowing my nose all day. 5 allergy pills later. So I'm thrilled. I totally forgot about this call today, so I'm really excited to hear what everyone has to say. We have a philanthropic services team of about, 11 of us now. And many of our families have both family foundations and donor advised funds, or are sort of slowly but surely transitioning out. And we are housing 6 different COVID-19 relief funds. So it's been a crazy time. I know all of you guys are having donors coming to you and addressing their, concerns or how can they help and all of that. And then a number of us are point people for some of these funds, 2 of which have actually raised over $30 million, which is crazy. Sounds like Monopoly money. But it's been amazing to see the support and the amount of philanthropy and the amount of generosity and coming together in the community, because as all of you probably know, this is our state, in particular the city of Chicago and the outlying communities, are one of the hardest hit areas in the country. In fact, our governor right now is on lockdown because someone on his staff just tested positive. So it's been a crazy time and a great time to be connected to NCFP.
Thanks, Abby. And I hope you feel better after all the allergy pills.
No, it could be a lot worse. I just didn't feel like any guys watch me blow my nose.
Understandable. Amy, do you want to say hi and introduce yourself, and then we'll go to Julia?
Absolutely. You can hear me, right,
Rita? Yep, perfect.
Fantastic. I'm Amy Radcliffe. I'm from the North Texas Community Foundation. Vicki is my director of donor relations, so I'm not going to speak too much because she'll, of course, be presenting here in a little bit. But it's Vicki and I in donor services, and she'll get into the stats. But we do work cross-functionally with lots of other departments. But happy to be here, and I didn't do the video because I'm kind of going back and forth with some donors and doing some email catch up. So happy to sit in and listen and hear some other good tips that some other foundations can share with us.
So Julia, we'll have you introduce yourself next, and then we'll go to Vicki, Ellen, and Nicole to keep the order on.
Hey everybody, this.
Oh, Julia, can anybody hear you? You're kind of freezing, but it's okay. Say more.
Sorry. This is, can you hear me now? Foundation. Okay. Is that better? Mm-hmm. Yes?
Yeah, that's better. Yes.
We're learning all of this. Julia Wood with the Community Foundation of Central Georgia, which is based in Macon, about an hour south of Atlanta. And our foundation has 8 staff people, and we've hired a donor services associate, and we're kind of in that transition period to, help bring her along so that free up time to focus more on the family work. In addition to our president, I'm the only one that does development or donor services exclusively right now, plus the new staff person. So we're in that transition, and if you've been there before, sometimes you have to retrain your donors to call a new person with a specific question. So we're kind of navigating those waters and trying to test out building a more formal family philanthropy program. Definitely a small shop.
Thanks, Julia. So we'll just hear from Vicki, Ellen, and Nicole. And I pushed them all to share because all their foundations are in different spots in their life cycle. Being a small shop, this is truly all your time. It's for all of you today. But just wanted you to be able to hear from some other folks. I know when I was at a community foundation, I went from, you know, a third of my time running a program to two FTEs running the same program in another foundation when I moved jobs. And like, I was jealous of everyone when I was a third. When we were two FTEs, I was still like figuring it out, but I think having people to look to really helped. So Vicki, if you wanna just get started and share.
Sure, so as Amy said, it really is a donor relations team of two. I've been there about 10 years, a little over 10 years. We're a relatively, well, so we have a smaller staff. We have 15 on staff. When I came on 10 years ago, we only had 4. So we've grown a lot in the last 10 years, but we are still smaller than most community foundations that have an asset size that we have. So we're a little bit jealous of other community foundations that have more people. But as Amy said, we have found a way to make it work by borrowing staff time from philanthropic services, from community impact, and from the finance team even some. So we have about 243 families that we work with, and that's on, you know, different levels. We, you know, Rose, our CEO, likes to say, we're here to externally customize but internally standardize. So that's what we really try to do and make everybody feel special. But we have tiered. That was something I learned pretty early on from other larger shops, community foundations. And so we have tiered. Amy has her own portfolio and has for a couple of years. So we've divided those 243 families between the two of us. So about 70% of our funds are donor advised funds. So a lot of maintenance, a lot of details and flexibility goes into that. So, but that's pretty much us.
What type of services do you guys end up providing to your families, if you don't mind sharing, like kind of what's the most popular, sure, but also the maintenance I know is a ton of time.
The maintenance is a ton of time, and especially during COVID-19. So there's three tiers. The standard tier is up to, for $25,000, up to $500,000. That's our first tier. And it basically, you know, they have they can reach out to Amy or I anytime. They have use of Donor Central is what we're using for their online grant making platform. However, we do have a lot of older donors, and so we do provide that paper form that they email or fax in. And, you know, we just moved into a new space and it was, do we have to take the fax machine? Can't we get rid of that stupid thing yet? But we're still hanging on to it because some of them do send it through that old fax machine. That's the number they know, even though we can get it through, you know, emails as well. So those are the basic services. And of course, investing, investments, and the finance team does a great job with all of our funds. The second tier is a little bit more robust, and we can help them with their grant making. And then the top tier, we provide research, family meetings. That is where we have several private foundations that have funds with us. And so we do handle their grant making, and we're trying to move them towards developing a fund with us. And the ones that we have had successfully for a couple of years have sort of handed over the reins to the community foundation and have been happy with our services in that regard. And we will continue to handle those funds after the donor passes away. So that's been a really nice thing. for all of our tiers, something that we started last year, we've been wanting to do it for a number of years. We don't have a lot of unrestricted funds at the Community Foundation in Fort Worth. So what we have decided to do is to bring along our donor advisors with us as we see needs in the community. So we have what's called a Good Grants program, and we do reach out to all of our fund holders to participate in grants alongside of us. So we do have a number of grant cycles, and we encourage the donors to participate on an individual level in those grant cycles. But then as Amy and I learn of needs from our community impacts team that are in the community, especially COVID-19, we've been sending out a lot of emails to our fund holders about needs in the community. We don't send everything to everybody, so we're very intentional and purposeful. And we look up, we know what that donor's interested in. We only send them things that they would be interested in seeing. So if they love, you know, children and education, we're not going to send them something on, you know, pets, neuter and spay. You know, we try to be very intentional with that. So I don't know if the intermediate services range from $500 up to $999,000, and then $1 million and up is our what we call our concierge services. So
awesome, thank you. I'm sure most folks have questions about when you're up to and how. Ellen is our newest community foundation, I was even telling people, but 4 years old as a community foundation. So we'll have Ellen share a little bit more about where they go.
Hi, everybody. Our foundation is called the Foundation for Delaware County, and we're based in Delaware County, Pennsylvania, right outside of West Philadelphia. And as Katie said, we are brand new. We've technically been in existence for 4 years. We're a healthcare conversion foundation. So, you know, the blessing of that is that we inherited $60 million. It took a while for all of that to come through. And by the time the board was assembled and our CEO was hired, a year had gone by. So we've really been just setting up the organization and getting it going over the past 3 years, and beginning to set up philanthropic services and then start to get the word out over the past 18 months, I'd say. One thing that's unique about our foundation, we were chatting a little bit earlier, is that we also inherited some public health programs that the health system had been managing, like WIC, Nurse Family Partnership, Healthy Start, and the board did make a decision to continue to run those programs, which is quite unique for a community foundation. We're not the only one, but there are not many who do run programs. So that's been very helpful in a lot of ways, also a little bit of a challenge because we get mostly government funding for that, but we do have to raise some money for that. So there's a lot going on. My position is Vice President for Advancement and Philanthropic Services, but it also completely includes communications. So managing in all of those different areas, then we do have not a very aggressive fundraising program, but we do need to raise some funds for operating and for the programs. So I have to spend some of my time in that as well. I can share a lot more, but I think we're just doing introductions right now, right?
I think so. I guess one other fact maybe to share is how many staff donors do you have?
Oh, yes.
Because that's a little bit different too, because you're 4 years old.
How many staff or how many fund holders?
How many fund holders?
Okay. Well, we inherited probably about 58 funds from the health system. Some of those folks are still around. Some of them are not around anymore. New funds, we've got about 17 total, about 9 donor advised funds, and a couple of scholarship funds, and several scholarship funds, and a few other types of funds. So very, very new.
No, and some of your families get amazing family philanthropy support, you know,
they do
because they want it.
They,
but more than I think some big foundations, like,
well,
out of big cities.
Yeah, one of your questions was about how you make those decisions. And I said, well, we're so small right now that, you know, I don't have to worry about that. And, you know, it's our mantra right now is just kind of, you know, listen and respond. And I drop everything when a family contacts us. And I have the luxury of being able to do that right now, but I'm also well aware of the time I spend and when we multiply the funds, which we fully expect and intend to do. There's no way that I can do it by myself. So we'll grow into that.
That's awesome. And I think, yeah, we're doing instructions, but you're also sharing a little bit, and then it'll just be a discussion. And your peers can ask y'all questions, which is the whole purpose of this. And you can answer each other's too. So Nicole is from Central Florida Foundation, and they're newer on their family philanthropy services journey. And so just Nicole, if you want to share where you guys are and kind of, you know, a little bit more about your foundation and what you do with the small team and how you kind of make it work.
Yeah, thank you for having me. And I'm in my bedroom, so I chose to add a virtual background so you don't have to see how crazy it is with my kids that just destroy it while I work. So I'm with the Central Florida Foundation. We're based in Orlando, Florida, and we are a 7-county region. There are several other community foundations in the state of Florida, and Orlando is kind of a unique community because we have a lot of people coming in and out. About 1,500 new people a week coming to Central Florida, maybe not anymore right now while nobody is traveling, but that was kind of the in and out. So we're not really that long established community that has deep roots of philanthropy. We're also a little different from some of the other parts of Florida where you see high net worth wealth. Our community, the average age is actually in the 40s. So we're also somewhat of a younger community. So lots of entrepreneurs and people kind of building that side outside of the sort of tourist industry that you think about with Disney and things like that being here. Our staff at the Central Florida Foundation, I think we have 11 staff, 10 currently in position. I'm the only person that manages anything related to development. So whether that's managing current fundholder relationships or prospecting for new, working with professional advisors. And then I also oversee our marketing communications manager. So I also wear a hat of thinking about marketing communications, which I feel like is kind of an advantage in development because I can tell her things that I want done around that. So that's good too. Because we've got such a small team, we work very closely together. And so my counterpart who works on community strategies and initiatives, we say I try to bring the dollars in and she tries to get the dollars out. So we work a lot to try to figure out how we can engage across those relationships. I've only been with the foundation for about a year and a half now. The community foundation has been in place for about 26 years, and our CEO has been with the organization for 20 or 21 of those years. We've got about 400, we have over 400 funds, and I'd say probably 25 to 30% of that are donor advised funds. So a fair portion of that is actually endowment. And we are engaged in a lot of different things across the board with, you know, I've been trying to work on getting some more done around family engagement, but I will say this, there's not been anyone in a development role at the Community Foundation for over 10 years. So it's kind of been trying to dig through what's been going on. And I think it was Julia that said introducing someone new and trying to get people to call them. I was that girl where I was trying to say, I promise you'll like me, call me, and they're so used to calling someone else. And so trying to just like get that relationship built, it's definitely taken at least a year to start getting that, where people will actually call and say, I want to speak to Nicole, and feel like they can have that conversation and trust. So just bear with the process and keep intersecting that person as much as you can. But yeah, I don't know if I left anything else, but that's who I am.
Well, I'd love to just make space for you guys to ask each other questions. I could come up with them too, but I think, you know, you've got Oregon Community Foundation here that runs family meetings, you know, and so you've got the breadth, you know, and so you've got the breadth of how people are providing those services. And I'll say, like, from the perspective of how they're billing for them, like on top of fund fees, or what they're choosing to provide to who and everything. And so I think how you guys manage your time is all amazing. So I would just love to make space for you guys to ask each other questions. I can come up with some, and I did ahead of time for these folks, but to think about. But what questions do you have for each other?
I was actually going to ask you, Vicki, with your kind of tiering, is that just sort of internal tiering, or are your fund holders aware that they're kind of a part of, like, have access to particular services based upon the size of their fund?
Yeah, great question. So at first, for a couple of years, they were just internally tiered, but we decided that we would try to move them along the continuum of, you know, concierge services. So we have, for new fund holders, we have a new fund holder meeting. We sit down with them and we have a notebook. And the notebook, really, the purpose of the notebook is to give them expectations, because what we found out is that when fund holders come to us, it's usually because their professional advisor or somebody has told them that's what they need to do with their money. So they come to us with very little knowledge about what a community foundation really is. So we provide this notebook, and we sit down and we just spend an hour with them. We promise that it's not going to be any longer than an hour, and we really do stick to that. But one of the pages in the notebook is, you know, what you can expect. And it does have the tiers broken down by the ranges that I said, basic, intermediate, concierge, and it kind of lists that. Now, when we show them that, and we don't dwell on it, we just make them aware that that's where that is. And we always say, if there's something, if you have a smaller fund, but there's something that you would like for us to do, just let us know. We want to help you with your philanthropy. That is our number one goal. So if you don't fall within that range, just let us know. We'll work it out. So if they wanted, for instance, we have had family meetings for some of the smaller or intermediate funds, I would say. But it was really good for us, because it was good for us to practice, and then it was good for them because it's going to move them up the continuum, because the goal that we're wanting to reach is that they do trust us with an estate gift. And so this helps us get there a little bit. And so it works for both of us.
I would pipe in, because we also in New Hampshire, we have the same tiering or similar tiering. We don't tell people that there's tiering, but we also we aren't very prescriptive about who gets what. So anyone can have a family meeting, but we like suggest it for people who have larger funds. We'll say, oh, I can come and do a family meeting with all your generations. And the smaller funds, we don't bring that up. But one thing that I think might be different is that we don't base ours on the fund size. We based ours on what we think the fund capacity over a lifetime could be. So a lot of our donors come to us from estate attorneys who say, you're going to have $2 million to give away in your estate. Start a donor advised fund right now with $25,000 so you can kind of see what it's like. And we treat those people as if they have a $2 million fund, because eventually that's what we hope it will be. So Vicki, I don't know if you guys do it on capacity or on actual dollars in, but.
So we tier them like this, but then we do prioritize within those tiers based on what you're saying. If they have an expectancy with us, if they come to our events, if they're engaged and they want to have a relationship with them, that really, you know, we do treat them differently because there's more engagement, and we want to foster that engagement more.
So if someone has a donor advised fund with you and then they decide they're going to, let's say their fund is 600,000 and then they decide that they want to spend out 300,000 in a year because they're concerned about COVID, do they drop into basic services or is it total lifetime giving?
They would. So we're right now, what we're doing is we're re-tiering on a yearly basis. You would be surprised at how many, though, don't move around that much. Now, we do have funds that intentionally they opened up the fund. They had the sale of a company or some kind of, you know, event, and they did open up a fund with the intention of spending it down in 5 years. Now, to me, I look at that as a little bit of a challenge, thinking, okay, we have 5 years to get them in the door and keep them, you know, and a lot of times we do, and they add to the fund, but most of them like to keep about the same size as when they opened it or else grow the fund. We do have the ones that intentionally close them. That's what they wanted to do all along. But we don't see a huge amount of movement, but we'll see. We'll see this next year when we tier them again, what it's like. The other thing I'll mention, which I don't know, I would be interested in knowing where you guys sit, but our expectancies, so we know that about 50% of our expectancies are current fund holders. So we treat them a little bit differently. So other expectancies that we know the money's coming in, but it's come through by word of a professional advisor. They've said, you don't need to do anything, but we just want you to know the money's coming to you at their death. We kind of put them on a list and we try to cultivate them by inviting them to events. That kind of stays in development and fundraising. But Amy and I do foster that relationship a little bit closer when we know there's an expectancy. And we know that there about 50% of our expectancy is through fund holders. So I would be interested in knowing kind of if you guys keep track of that and what percentage of yours are current fund holders.
I think we've been, I'll just be very candid in saying, in the process of coming in where there's not been as much detailed tracking of everything, that's kind of been a part of what I've been trying to figure out. So we have basically, we're a setup with, if we know that somebody is planning to leave something in their state, we try as much as possible to create what we call a future fund, not super innovative, but so that we can have something to kind of have them outline what they'd like to see done with that. And if they are a current fund holder, I mean, for me, I've been trying to now set the tone with all of the fund holders that I'm meeting with that we're going to always have at least a review 1 to 2 years. So that they know to expect to hear from me. And I've been looking across the board at so many of the original fund agreements where we have there's no plan afterwards, and there's not been a conversation around how that connects to their estate planning. So we're kind of in this space of just doing that now. I do feel that I feel that a good majority of our I don't know the exact percentage, but a fair amount are either committed to having some kind of an endowment that they want to leave or connect it within their estate plans, or have made the plan to support the foundation through unrestricted use. So that way we have that available for whatever the community needs are moving forward.
I can share that for a long time, we didn't track it well. We had these paper files we called red files that got created and put in a drawer. And about 6 years ago, a couple of donors we worked with had a lunch and shared feedback from some folks who had left us in their will and felt unstewarded. So we've tried to become more formal with it. We now create funds for them in our database. And we have, if they have an advised fund or a scholarship fund, the relationship manager attached to it is supposed to be doing that stewardship. Otherwise, if there's not another fund, it's our development staff. But we could be doing a lot better, and we know that. And I think we need to make a goal of getting more of our current donors to create estate gifts for us. So I think we'll be trying to get our relationship managers better trained to ask questions and work in that way. And I mean, the biggest gifts we've ever gotten have come from estate gifts where we didn't have a relationship. That's like the surprises we've gotten. But there's so much better we could be doing there, but it's going to mean training staff who haven't talked about that kind of thing to get more comfortable being proactive about it.
Can I ask, does that mean, like, some foundations have unlimited successor advisors, and that's a big question, obviously, as you structure fees and things on term, but some only have two? But that does mean if you die, you left the money in your estate, that your children who, you know, like I remember working at a community foundation seeing names and we had no contact info, like goodness forbid, my last name is Scott, you know, like, Stacy typed in, she was curious, like how folks engage successor advisors. And I think too, like, do you get the contact info? Like, how are you, especially for the wills, but just in general, how are you guys engaging that next class, whether it's too allowed or forever?
We allow our funds to go on as long, each successor advisor can then name successor advisors. So we do have some funds that are now on their third set of advisors. We do get the information. We technically have yearly check-ins with most of our fund holders or who's ever willing to be checked in on yearly, because you know there's some people that don't want that. And when we do that, about not every visit, but maybe once every 2 to 3 years, we just give them a form and say, hey, here's what we think you're planning to have happen. Is this still what you want? And if it's your kids, are these still their addresses? And so that's how we update. And then we have a fairly new policy where now if the successor advisors are on board and they don't make a grant for 3 or 4 years, then we start really aggressively contacting them in an effort. And then if they still don't respond, then we reserve the right to spend their funds for them. And that's come up right now because obviously there's never been in the last century, there's never been a time where communities are as desperate for money as they are now. And so this is a time where we're really leaning into, are you going to use this money or not? Because if you're not, we're going to at least spend the 4% distribution. So that's what we do.
We do a similar thing, but when we have meetings on the agenda, is, you know, successor advisors. And so we do always go over that and we ask, you know, if they're willing to share that information, we would love to have it. We don't want, after they die, their first introduction of the community foundation for us to come and say, oh, by the way, you know, you have this money to spend. And sometimes you make a great point. Sometimes you don't have that contact information. The children don't live locally. So we do at least try to get that sort of information, name, age, where they live, so that we could potentially find them. But we also have a clause written in, like Sarah, that after 3 years, if the successor donor advisors don't make any grants, then we are able to. And then we've gone back and forth because we don't have many unrestricted funds. We would like to start writing in that if, you know, the successor advisor no longer wants to advise this fund, that it will turn into a field of interest or an unrestricted fund at the community foundation. I know a lot of community foundations just that's normal and that's how they get their unrestricted funding. We haven't completely moved to that. We do it when, you know, we think that a donor would be okay with that, but we certainly don't want them to keep them from opening a fund.
would add that we have a successor advisor addresses, and we do send them, I'm almost positive we at least send them our twice a year magazine so that they at least know who we are.
We have a two generation policy, but we'll bend it for certain size funds. And we have some older funds that have advisors in perpetuity. We really push for doing like an orientation with the parent and the children when possible, so that they can kind of hear from their parents what they want them to do. In the last couple of years, we've had a handful of funds where we had to split it into separate funds because the siblings don't get along. And it was challenging. So, and then sometimes we get a fund where the parents don't tell them and they think they're getting an inheritance and they're not. And then they get to give this money away. And then that's always challenging too. So whenever ever possible, we really push to do the kind of joint family meeting and discuss before people are no longer here.
Yeah, we had a $1 million fund at the foundation, and I came in fairly new, and the parents had set up the fund, and it was made up of 5 siblings, and none of them got along, and they would call and complain about the other siblings. And within the last probably 4 months, all but I think one have decided to basically take their portion out and move it into a financial institution. As much as we kind of talked about the ability to create their own separate funds at the foundation. And that to me was just sucked, just to know that they would just leave. But obviously the relationship was really just the parents. And I'm not sure, you know, if more could have really been done, and they all hated each other anyway. But it's interesting family dynamics like that, that, you know, the intent from the parent side was one thing, but ultimately that ended up. And I feel like that is one of the potential sacrifices that could happen with the successor advisors not being all fully on the same page, or maybe it's integrated into the setup of the fund.
What other questions do you guys have for one another? This is truly just your space.
I'm interested to hear, when you guys talk about family meetings, what does that mean for those of you who have them?
Well, the meeting.
Go ahead, Ellen.
I just feel I'm learning so much from all of you because we are so new. But the meetings that we've had so far have been mainly with the parents. And we do have successor advisors, and we have their addresses and things like that. In one case, one family has teenagers, and they have come, and we've met with all of them, and we've talked about what their interests are. Since that time, I've learned about a lot of wonderful tools like NCFP and 2164 and things like that. So I'm really looking forward to using some of that with families in the future. But in this one case, it really did help us guide them to what they were interested in. And as it turns out, some of their major interests were different from the foundation's interests and the grant making that we do. So it worked out really well because we received some applications and we were able to, you know, invite them to support these organizations, and they chose to do so. So I think, again, like I said earlier, just listening and being responsive, but we haven't gotten more sophisticated with our family meetings yet, and I'd love to hear what others have to say.
So ours are very simple. They're not a half-day retreat like I know a lot of people do. What we found is that our donors really don't have time to do that. They get together with their kids on the holidays, and the time is taken with family time. But we have had a couple with the kids. And we, Amy and I, are both trained on 2164, and we use their resources, mostly the Picture Your Legacy. That's just what's real easy, and we like to use it. We have the curriculum that we've written for that, and it works. So really 2 hours, maybe 3 tops, depending on what the family can do. And if they want to write a mission statement or purpose statement, we help them do that. That is something that we've kind of learned we do afterwards, because they go through multiple iterations of the same thing. But finding their common interests and how that overlaps with their grant making, and then maybe bringing in one family meeting we had, we sort of knew what their interests were. And so we had 3 nonprofits that we thought were doing really, really good work in that area. So we brought each one of those nonprofits in for 15 minutes. So that took up part of the time. But they really enjoyed it. They wrote their own mission statement and they had fun going back and forth. So that was really, I thought that was really successful, and we need to, that was actually our second meeting with them. So we probably need to go ahead and schedule the third. And it's easy with them because they all live in town and they all work together. So they kind of have the same schedule. The other thing that we've done that I want to figure out how to do better. So if you guys have done this, I would love to try to figure out some kind of little package that you can give to them in November, and they can do some of those exercises and those family, either a game or something that they could do together, maybe put popcorn in there, so that they can do something on their own. You don't have to facilitate it, but it sort of accomplishes the same thing, and maybe they can fill out a worksheet and give it back to you after the holidays are over, because they really love the idea of spending time together and getting to be together, but they just can't get it scheduled. So are y'all, do y'all sort of have that same issue?
Yeah, I find that the family meetings where the family's all here and where the families get along and they like each other seem to be the easiest to gather. We had one that was, you know, 2 generations around the table, and they still engage in some business together. The mother's still living, the husband's passed, but there's 5 kids, and they all easily are able to gather around the table face to face, and we're able to have that conversation. But through that, learn that they haven't had any discussions into the next generation. So even though some of their kids are now, you know, in their 20s or 30s, they haven't really had that discussion. So I feel like that's gone well. When it's been, I don't know for all of you, but I feel like oftentimes with the first generation is oftentimes I feel like kind of determining for their children when they're going to be willing to participate. So I always hear a lot of, well, they're busy kind of doing their thing right now and in their life, and so, you know, we'll get to that later on. And then later on, who knows when that'll be, and then it might not be until there is no later on. So I don't know if there's magic to being able to kind of push that a little bit to get them to engage sooner. And I don't know if that's just a natural sort of discomfort in not wanting to broach it, because it's not a comfort, it's not a place that they're used to being in discussion with their family. So I'll welcome to hear any sort of tips and tricks around that piece of it.
You guys, this is Abby, and it's been really interesting because obviously we're large in Chicago, but I feel like there's so much to learn from the way you guys are doing things. And I really wonder if in light of COVID-19 and people realizing that they have to start viewing life a little different, maybe before we get back, you know, as human beings, we have a tendency to go back to old ways. Maybe one of the only few good things out of all of this is the fact that it's going to be a while before any of us get back to our old ways. I don't know, maybe, sorry, maybe now is the time to reach out to some of your donors with, like, you know, a little note or phone call and just say, you know, I mean, kind of share your own personal things. Like, you know, my family and I have realized we have to start thinking about how we communicate with each other better, or, you know, maybe now would be a really good time to think about. I mean, I think about the fact that I have my power of attorney sitting in the trunk of my car from when I redid it, you know, naming like my brother as, you know, power of attorney over finance, my sister power of attorney over healthcare, so I could divide it up evenly and not hurt anyone's feelings. And yet it's been sitting in my car and I'm like, you know, maybe I should think about getting them their copy. Like, you know, like we all put stuff off thinking we have plenty of time. And if there's one really good lesson to learn from what's been going on is you can never plan for the unplanned. So maybe now is the time to reach out to, especially if you don't have as many, and, you know, or maybe start picking which ones you should reach out to first or the ones you've had pushback in the past. I don't know. It's just a thought. I feel like if we can take some of these lessons and not wait for the next emergency before we make changes, that would be some of the good things to come. So I don't know, it's just a thought. I was going to write it, but I thought I hate being such an eavesdropper on your conversations. They're so good that I better participate a little.
Oh, anybody's welcome to come and talk. I will say one of the community foundations in our network spoke on an AdNet call last week, and they have divided up calling donors over 65 or 70 who are single, and just doing a wellness check call. But like a little bit nicer than that, but truly a wellness check call and just checking in with them as a person. So I think there are lots of folks doing that. We have had folks share out different resources. I will say, like, Phil's philanthropy toolbox from Indiana Philanthropy Alliance is comics about philanthropy. The other thing some folks have done is if you have a good philanthropic advisor network, doing a service project for them in October so that then they learn and talk to their donors about it in November, kind of that type of thing, or sending out a service project list. In NCFP notes, I will share three announcements with you just so you guys have more programs. And then if you have a question for each other, you're welcome to ask. But next week we have a program, May 20th, about engaging youth. I will say the number of people that are doing youth philanthropy or next gen grants around COVID is a number you could count on your hand, or maybe you might need an extra finger. It's not that many. So we have released a list of COVID-related resources for engaging youth and next gen. If you send it to a donor, please read it first, because it may not apply to your community's laws, just to be honest, or how your family is interpreting restrictions. But we have contacted some families that are doing this work with youth and next gen, a lot of it being coincidental. They were doing it already. So they repurposed that grant making, but they're going to be talking about how to do this. And we know some of our families are waiting until the summer to do more of that response. They kind of got first round of cash out the door and are doing second round with the kids or grandkids. So if you're interested in how folks are having those conversations or facilitating them, both staff and community foundations, come next week. We also have a Spark session next week. And also your community foundation workshop on October 7th or 8th. Is going virtual. You'll be getting an email. That means you can come from your house and there's no travel costs. So that'll be up on our website shortly. So you can send up to 3 staff from your foundation, which for those of you that are small staff might be everybody, but feel free to know that that sign up is coming and an updated agenda is coming, because you're all not awake the same hours, but October 7th and 8th, that you can tune in to virtually meet with your peers for a day and a half. So thanks, everybody. Any other questions? Your team just also thank you to each other.
Thank you,
everyone.
Y'all take care.
You too.
Thanks, everybody.
Good to see you.
Bye.
Thanks.